At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Some days, like today, the economic news can be a little cognitively dissonant. We'll explain. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Thursday, today the 25th of February. Good, as always, to have you along, everybody. We are going to start, to be honest, with a little bit of economic whiplash. So apologies in advance, but these are whiplashy times in this economy. First of all, it's Thursday, as I said, so we got another snapshot of the American labor market this morning. Another 1.2 million people made first-time claims for unemployment benefits. That's both at the state level and applications for federal pandemic benefits. And as you know, because we mentioned it just yesterday, Fed Chair Jay Powell and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen figure the actual unemployment rate right now is something like 10%. That is really, really high. But that said, most of the people in this economy who want to be working are, and some of them have been able to save through the pandemic because those fortunate enough to have cash to spend have had fewer places to spend it. And that gets us to the whiplash, because there are big expectations that come spring and vaccines and the aftertimes. There is going to be a whole lot of pent-up demand let loose. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going.
A lot of people had to drastically change their spending in the pandemic because they lost jobs or their hours were cut. But at the same time, most consumers
are still feeling secure or optimistic about their finances.
Candace Corlett is president of WSL Strategic Retail, which regularly surveys shoppers.
I wouldn't expect a boom, but people will be back in the store and there will be pent-up demand for the experience.
A lot of people enjoy browsing stores, especially after months of enforced online shopping. Another area expecting a post-pandemic boost? Travel. Katie Thomas runs the Kearney Consumer Institute.
I've talked to some clients within the hospitality industry, and they are seeing folks start to book again for the back half of the year. So there is some optimism there.
Optimism, yes, but many of those bookings and deposits can be canceled or refunded, just like the vacation I'm planning with my family for October. Fingers crossed. Plus, says Yale economist Stephen Roach,
I think we've released a lot of pent-up demand into the economy already.
He points to data on sales of durable goods. Throughout the pandemic, those who can spend money have been on big furniture and appliances and such.
The fortunate have managed to do well, but a large swath of the nation has not, and they're unlikely to unleash anything in the way of pent-up demand.
He says we'll probably see some surge in spending, but not necessarily as much as a quick recovery will need. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Some of that surge in spending that Kimberly was talking about is going to happen in New York City. We're starting tomorrow Restaurants are going to be allowed to seat people indoors at 35% capacity. Next week, it's movie theaters, which have been closed for nearly a year. They're going to reopen in New York City at 25% capacity. The big question, of course, is whether people are actually going to come out, as Marketplace's Jasmine Garst reports.
The city that never sleeps is slowly waking up. But for many restaurants, the last year of the pandemic has been more like a nightmare. A survey by the New York City Hospitality Alliance found that 92% of restaurants could not afford to pay their rent in December. Andrew Ridgie is the executive director of the alliance. He says while he welcomes the expanded indoor seating,
pre-pandemic, it was tough enough for restaurants to survive when they had 100% occupancy in a good economy. So 35% is not enough. So many restaurateurs say they need at least 50%.
Also coming soon to New York, movie theaters. But Professor Arun Sharma at the University of Miami wonders, what are people even going to watch?
People are cautious about going to public gatherings. And number two, there's not enough good movies coming out.
There is pent-up demand and cash. Despite the unemployment crisis, a lot of people who haven't lost their jobs haven't been spending money. There hasn't been anywhere to spend it. Professor Alex Susskind at Cornell University says millennials who love their food delivery apps won't be rushing out, but
folks like me, Gen X and the boomers, we miss restaurants.
But 51-year-old Amanda Whitten from Brooklyn says there is no way she's going out until she gets vaccinated against COVID-19.
I know people who've had it like last spring, who still haven't gotten lung function back all the way. And I'm just not willing to roll those dice.
So is the city ready for dinner and a movie? Chances are it'll take more than a New York minute. In New York, I'm Jasmine Garst for Marketplace.
You might have heard Wall Street had a tough day today. Yeah. It did. You know why? Because stocks go down too, people. Come on. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We're a couple of months, give or take, from planting season in a lot of the country. A chance for farmers to turn over some fresh earth, literally and figuratively, as they put a difficult 2020 behind them. So we thought we might get an early start on American Agriculture 2021 with a call the other day to one of our regulars. Brian Duncan is his name. He's a hog, corn, and soybean farmer, also the vice president of the Illinois Farm Bureau. Mr. Duncan, Kai Rizdal in Los Angeles. How are you, sir?
Really good, Kai. Great to talk to you again.
As you sit there thinking about what you're going to put in the ground, let me ask you how the market is in agriculture in the central part of this country.
Well, the markets have turned sharply higher since last harvest. And so, you know, I would say for the first time in 4 or 5 years, we can feel optimistic. We're looking at some pretty improved prices. Part of that, unfortunately, was due to 2 years' worth of short crops, 2019 and 2020. That's resulted in a shortage of supply, which has proven to lead to higher prices.
Higher prices, I imagine, make for happy farmers. It sounds like you're feeling better than you were last time, which was almost a year ago, and you were fairly glum, as most of us were.
Oh, yeah, certainly the COVID curveball, if you want to call it that, was one that was really hard on agriculture. We saw demand destruction occur all over the place, from usage of biofuels to consumption of animal proteins in restaurants and other countries around the world having economic difficulties, which led to a slowdown in exports. Yeah, it was not a very enjoyable experience for agriculture to go through.
As you sit here now, though, on you know, the cusp of what looks to be a good market season for you, and hopefully us getting out of this pandemic in the short term future, has agriculture changed for you, or are you back to normal where you want to be?
Yeah, that's a great question, Kai, and I don't even know what normal is anymore. as we look around what the future demand curve, even for say biofuels, looks like.
Yeah,
we see some hope that positivity rates continue to decline, and so maybe people can start gathering together again, sitting in ballparks and eating lots of hot dogs. As a hog farmer, that would be one of the things that would make me very happy. So for right now, we're grateful. We've made it through and have some good markets, at least looking forward for this calendar year.
You know, it's funny. I'm recalling, as I sit here taking notes on what you're saying, the last time we talked, I asked you what agriculture was going to look like once this pandemic's done. And you said to me, tell me what consumer demand is. And that goes to your biofuels thing. It goes to your hot dogs in a ballpark thing. We, just like other parts of this economy are changing, so too is agriculture, depending on what consumers are going to want.
Yeah, absolutely. And how many habits have changed with COVID, and how many of those habits will remain changed? Will people get back in restaurants? Will they drive to work like they used to, or is everybody going to work from home? I think there's a lot of questions, but I also think maybe there's some pent-up economic activity too, Kai, and that's what I'm hopeful for. I'm hoping that people are waiting for the opportunity to rush out to restaurants and take those trips that maybe they weren't able to take last year. So, you know, that's the flip side. Maybe we could see a real rush of economic activity based on pent-up demand. That remains to be seen yet.
One hopes. That's why we're doing a thing on pent-up demand on the show later on this week. Let me ask you just really quickly on the way out here. You are, of course, an official of the Illinois Farm Bureau. You've got macro responsibilities in that state. You're a farmer, too, though. I mean, how are things at your farm? Are the hog piglets growing now or whatever season that is?
Yeah, sure. So we have hogs all the time. And things are good. You know, I'm fortunate. My wife and I are on a family farm, and we have three of our children involved farming with us that we get to see on a daily basis. And we're really optimistic, looking forward to what we hope is a good year.
Doesn't get any better than that. Brian Duck, and he does hogs and corn and soybeans in Illinois, also the vice president, as I said, of the Illinois Farm Bureau. Mr. Duncan, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Always great to talk with you, Kai.
Talk to you soon. What's that? You say you want the latest and greatest on business and economic news early in the morning? David Brancaccio and the gang on the Marketplace Morning Report have just what you're looking for. Check it out. Over the past year, a lot of us have gotten to know our houses a lot better from the inside, and not always in a good way. Every crack and bit of peeling paint, all the things you've become house blind to, got harder to unnotice. And now, as the weather warms up, attention turns to the outside, which is kind of a post-winter thing, pandemic or not. And you start noticing things, very specific things. For our series Adventures in Housing Marketplaces, Amy Scott got an education in house observation.
Scott Seidler has a thing about shutters.
I think shutters are beautiful. You get them on a colonial revival or a house where they belong, and they're amazing. But I just think that America has no clue how to use shutters right now.
I know, America, we've got a lot going on. But think about it. Shutters were invented to keep the weather out, so they needed to be the same height as the window and half the width, so they'd cover it when they were closed. But on a lot of houses these days,
they are like set decorations. They're vinyl, they're screwed into the wall, they're not the right size, and it just baffles me that people don't understand the simple idea that a shutter shuts.
And if it doesn't, it should at least look like it could.
And if you have something that is like a sliver of the window size, what exactly is that doing?
Seidler didn't just wake up one day with a shutter fixation. He restores old houses for a living. His company, Austin Historical in Orlando, specializes in windows and doors. He'd drive around the city where there's a lot of newer housing. And when you're a window guy, you notice windows. Then one day, about 4 years ago, his wife called from her car.
She said, you've got to go buy this house. It has these razor-thin shutters painted like this really gaudy pink color.
That wasn't even the worst of it.
They're on the sides of the garage door. You need to see it.
A garage door with shutters.
I took a picture. I posted it on Instagram. And then I was like, you know what? I keep seeing them. They're everywhere. I'm going to start posting this every Sunday.
And hashtag Shutter Sunday, Shutter with two Ds, was born. I think we need a little music. There are shutters that are too skinny, too short, too long, rectangular shutters for curved windows, and curved shutters for rectangular windows. There's the three-story mega shutter, the painted-on shutter, even the under shutter, below the window. In each photo, the offending shutters are circled in red and labeled fail, nope, or my favorite, what? Fans started sending him photos from around the country.
It got such a huge reaction. I went, oh, good. I'm glad I'm not alone. And I'm not just this really cranky old guy who's like, these darn shutters are just terrible.
How old are you, by the way?
I'm 43.
A cranky young guy.
Yeah.
Seidler gets that people are often just trying to dress up a plain house, and vinyl shutters are a relatively cheap way to do that. His real passion is the windows themselves, teaching homeowners how to restore and preserve them so they won't have to spend tens of thousands of dollars replacing them. Which brings us to...
All right, party people, it is Window Wednesday.
Seidler, who got his start in musical theater, does weekly sessions on Instagram Live, answering questions about putty and pulleys and how to unstick a stuck window, one big reason people replace their old windows. The whole shutter shaming thing is just a gateway.
It's really to help educate people. And I think if you make people laugh while you're educating them, it sticks.
Seidler says he's only heard from one homeowner he showcased on Instagram, and they were pretty cool about it. But he has heard from people who took down their shutters to avoid getting called out, and some people think it's mean. After we talk, I walk out onto my front porch. There's something I need to check. Uh-oh. Yep, vinyl. At least they're the right size. No, actually, they're not. They're, like, skinny. Fail. At an undisclosed address, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Shutters on my house? Wood, but definitely screwed in place. Couldn't close them if we wanted to, and also totally the wrong size. I don't even think there are hinges, actually. We have some of those shutter picks that Amy was talking about on our website. And look, while you're there, fill us in on your adventure in housing, would you? Our home address is marketplace.org. Coming up.
This situation has just been 100 times better than I ever anticipated.
Some things are actually blessings in disguise. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawa's. Dow Industrial's down 559, 1 7/10%, 31,402. The NASDAQ shed 478 points, 3.5%. Finished at 13,119. The S&P 500 down 96, 2.4%. Closed at 38.29. Tough day for tech stocks, as if you couldn't tell by the NASDAQ there. Microsoft dipped 2 3/10% today. Google parent company Alphabet down 3 2/10%. Apple soured 3 4/10%. Apple sour, get it? COVID or no, some folks out there are still spending. L Brands, owner Victoria's Secret and Bath & Body Works, grew 1 3/10% today. Best Buy plummeted 9.2%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.52%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Lawmakers in Texas spent their day talking about why so many people went without electricity and water for so long as those lawmakers try to figure out what to do next after that state's deep freeze a week or so ago. Governor Greg Abbott has already said he would, and this is a quote, mandate and fund the winterization and stabilization of the Texas power infrastructure. And he's doing that to make sure the grid doesn't fail again, obviously. About which, though, two things. The Texas grid is now infamously unregulated. And number two, getting winterization done is going to be complicated. From Austin, Marketplace's Andy Euler is on that one.
In Texas, more often than not, it's extreme heat and drought that power generators are fighting. But as we've seen, winter storms can happen.
What's unique for us is we will have both really cold and really hot.
And so Michael Weber, who teaches mechanical engineering at the University of Texas, says the state has to be prepared for more typical heat and also to prevent cold weather from freezing and breaking the infrastructure of power plants.
That's hard, entirely solvable from an engineering perspective, but it could be more expensive.
Not only more expensive up front, but he says the technology used to prevent freezing makes for less efficient generation in the summer. The governor not only promised winterization of the Texas grid, he also said the state would figure out a way to pay for it. Caitlin Smith at the energy consultancy AB Power Advisor says the governor can mandate changes, even though the market is largely deregulated, but power companies aren't going to want to pay.
Because without a funding mechanism in place from the governor or legislature, there is no cost recovery for those generators that need to winterize.
And even if policymakers commit to investing in winterizing the power grid, Daniel Cohan, professor of environmental engineering at Rice University in Houston, says that'll only address one part of the problem that folks encountered during the freeze.
We have three systems that really failed each other this time.
Electricity, but also gas and water. And he says the governor's mandate only deals with the power problem.
Our water systems weren't prepared for losing power. Our gas systems went down and knocked out the gas supply to the power plants.
So far, the governor hasn't offered any specifics on who will end up paying, whether it's taxpayers or ratepayers or some combination of both. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Back this past late summer, early fall, when school was starting, we heard a lot about pandemic learning pods. Instead of sending kids to school in person or having them do it online, some parents formed their own micro schools, hiring teachers to teach handfuls of kids at a time. Well, here we are in February, and what started as an experiment might actually have some legs, as Marketplace's Erica Barris reports.
Halfway through the school year, a sixth kindergartner pod in Fairfax, Virginia is hard at work.
You need to pour this over a plate, not a little tiny lid.
I did.
I see that. And girls.
This was a cookie decorating lesson, part of the curriculum of a pod Allison Freed put together last summer. The classroom is in the basement of the house where she lives with her husband and three children. She did it because the public schools in her district were going fully remote, and her oldest child was about to start kindergarten.
We just could not wrap our brains around how 5- and 6-year-olds who are still learning their letters, still learning their numbers, don't know how to work a computer, were going to be expected to kind of learn through that medium.
Freed put a call out, found 5 other families, hired a teacher, and added to their homeowner's insurance. Parents had to withdraw their children from the local school district. Each family pays $1,000 a month to cover the teacher, a cleaning crew, and supplies.
The cost per family and what we would be paying out of pocket was literally 50% of what we were paying the year before for a private preschool.
Freed calls the pod amazing. She says the kids have a strong bond and they're learning.
I find myself having extreme hesitancy thinking about going from this situation that has just been 100 times better than I ever anticipated and thinking of sending her back into a public school classroom.
Freed's worried about the variables. Will it be hybrid? What about vaccinations? Will the kids really be able to interact? Marty West is a professor at Harvard's Graduate School of Education. A recent survey he worked on found that 6% of K-12 students in the U.S. are in some kind of academic pod.
On one hand, that sounds like a fairly small percentage. At the same time, it does represent more than 3 million students nationwide.
West is watching to see if the pandemic pod experience will continue to draw families away from public school districts towards private schools, homeschooling, and pods.
And if that's the case, that would have big implications for school district finances.
Those budgets are mostly based on the previous year's enrollments. Some parents are keeping their kids enrolled in their local district and supplementing with a pod. That's what Allison Irungwe has done in Riverside, California. Her daughter attends first grade remotely and is in a Spanish language pod with 4 other kids. They meet a few hours a day, a couple days a week. Irungwe started the pod and thinks she might keep it going next year, even though the first teacher she hired quit as cases were rising in the fall.
She didn't feel that all the families were doing exactly what they should be to follow the guidelines and be safe.
Despite the waivers and contracts and codes of conduct, there isn't always institutional stability in these arrangements. And there's also human nature. Adam Scales is with the Rutgers Center for Risk and Responsibility. He personally hasn't heard of any COVID-19 related pod lawsuits. They'd be hard to prove.
I think it's pretty unlikely that somebody who you directly trusted with your kid 3 weeks ago is going to seem an attractive target absent egregious misconduct. Not that it's not possible, but I think it would take a lot.
For Allison Freed in Virginia, the contracts everyone signed have been crucial to the pod's success.
Part of the agreement with the families is that we're all being extremely careful. You're only going to critical need places.
But in January, she and her three children got COVID. The pod shut down, no one else got sick, and the pod is now back in session. This month, some in-person learning resumed in her district. Even so, Freed is thinking the pod may outlast the pandemic. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today. I missed this the other day somehow when Bloomberg had the story. A new trend in beer brewing, which regular listeners will know that I have an interest in, the beer part, not the brewing part. Anyway, performance beer is the story. Brewers, small ones, and to date just a small number of them, adding electrolytes to their beers so that people dehydrate less when they drink them. I am all in favor of innovation, but I don't, that's not why you, beer's not for that. All right, we got to go, but here's your Thursday moment of economic context, another entry in the, if we stop talking about this, we are going to stop talking about it file. Before this year, do you know how many black women had been the CEO of a Fortune 500 company? One. Ursula Burns at Xerox. And then in January, Walgreens announced Rosalind Brewer was going to be its next CEO. And today, TIAA, the big insurance and financial services company, said Thesunda Brown Duckett is going to take over in May. So that's three total. Amir Bibawi, Siobhan Brett, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Kat Green, Rick Carr, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.